Here again is John Hickman.
By 1957, much of John Meston's time was devoted to writing the television series. Other writers were called upon for the radio scripts. Again, Norman McDonald.
One of the other people that wrote for us was Les Crutchfield. I first came to know Les when he was still working at Caltech as an engineer. But at that time, which must have been 46 or 47, he came in to see Bill Robeson with a script for a Columbia workshop, which Bill bought, and Les was on his way toward being a very successful writer. Les worked with me on later on Escape and on Romance and a number of shows. And when we did start Gunsmoke, it just was obvious that Les would have to be part of the family, which indeed he was. He wrote not as many as Meston, but more perhaps than any other single writer. Les was a warm and very funny and very charming man. He was his own man, and he did what he wanted when he wanted, so if you needed him desperately to do a script, he might be available, or he might have been on his way to Africa, and you really never knew. But when he was in town, he wrote well, and he was dependable. Perhaps Les did more of the light or of the comedy shows than John Meston. One in particular that I always enjoyed was a script called Colleen So Green, which in which this attractive girl comes to town and completely befuddles Doc and Chester and everybody else in town, including Mr. Botkin at the bank. But one of Les's scripts that I remember particularly, and perhaps personifies the kind of writing that made him such a valuable piece of manpower for Gunsmoke, was a script that he wrote called Tag You're It.
Was you saying something, Mr. Dillon?
What is that?
Oh, this is a duck call. I ordered all the way from St. Louis. It just come in the mail.
Doesn't sound like any duck I ever heard.
Oh, it's guaranteed, Mr. Dillon. See, any duck that hears this comes right at you.
You better be careful. We don't want the jail overrun with them.
Oh, well, there ain't none around yet, but they're just about due. When they start coming through, I'm going to get down there in them bushes along the river with a shotgun and this thing. And, Mr. Dillon, we're going to be eating roast duck every day for 3 months.
I'm glad to hear that, Chester.
It takes kind of a knack to blowing it.
Uh-huh.
It takes a little dab of practice, and I ain't got it down exact yet, but I will.
Gentlemen.
Come in, mister.
You're Marshal Dillon?
Yeah, that's right.
I am Cyrus Taggart, Marshal. Possibly you've heard of me.
I'm afraid not, but what can I do for you, Mr. Taggart?
You can give me your complete cooperation.
Oh?
I have here a photograph of a young lady. I have reason to believe she is in Dodge City.
Why, Mr. Dillon, that...
Go on, Mr. Taggart. Suppose she is here.
She's my daughter, Evie Taggart. She ran away from home nearly a year ago, and she has made it very difficult to find her.
And if you do find her?
I shall take her back to New York with me, naturally. I assume from your partner's exclamation that you do know her.
Not by that name.
Yes, well, she has used a number of false names during the past year. Very well, you will take me to her at once.
How old is your daughter, Mr. Taggart?
24.
And then she's of legal age. Suppose she won't go back with you.
Marshal, the Taggart Enterprises include railroads, several banks and finance companies, along with mining and cattle interests. I, with my father and my grandfather before me, did not acquire them by tolerating interference with our wishes.
Now, why did she run away in the first place?
Because she's a willful, headstrong little fool. Marshal, we're wasting time.
Mr. Taggart, I'm not going to take you to her. Not just yet.
May I remind you...
Your enterprises, sir, don't include the United States Marshal's office.
I imagine my influence could extend that far, if you compel me to use it.
You do as you like, but... But I'm going to talk to the girl first. I'm going to find out what she wants to do.
What she wants is of no importance.
Good day, Mr. Taggart.
She keeps pretty late hours, Mr. Dillon. Maybe she ain't up yet.
Yeah, maybe not.
Hello, Marshal. Chester.
Morning, Patsy. Or, I guess it's Evie Taggart now, isn't it?
Oh. He's here, huh?
Mm-hmm. Over the Dodge House. He says he's come to take you home.
Where is it?
It's all right, Burl. Come on in.
Oh, thank you.
Wouldn't do any good to run. Not now.
I thought I heard you talking to some... Oh.
You know Burl Alden, don't you, Marshal?
Yeah, you deal blackjack, don't you, over the Golden Horn part-time?
That's right. What's the trouble, Marshal?
My father's here, Burl. Finally caught up with me.
Well, what of it? You're over 21. He can't do nothing.
You don't know him.
What can he do, Marshal? She's got a right to live her life the way she wants, ain't she?
Yeah, as far as the law's concerned. And he may try other ways.
He will. He'll do anything. I know him.
He'll be sorry if he tries anything. I'll stick with you. You know that.
I know, Burl. But I know how he can be. That's why I never wanted him to find me.
Are you sure that you don't want to go back with him, Evie?
Of course I'm sure.
That's a rough life you're leading here, working in a long branch, having to put up with any man who comes along who's got the price of a drink.
Anything would be better than going back home. You don't know what it was like, Marshal. I don't really matter to him. I never did. It's just the family name he cares about. He's afraid I'll disgrace it. I'm not going back.
He says you are, Evie. And I'd say he's used to getting his own way.
No matter what I have to do, I'm not going back. No matter what.
Sam, the men back at the faro table want another round when you get a chance.
All right, Kitty.
Let Margie take it back to him, huh?
Okay.
Hello, Kitty.
Oh, Matt, I didn't see you come in.
Well, you look busy, so I kept quiet.
You know, I just as soon you hadn't come in tonight, Matt.
Oh? Well, I can always have a beer up the street.
No, it's just that I did something this evening that I hate myself for.
Oh? Well, what do you mean?
Come on, let's sit down.
All right. Oh, what's it all about?
Well, that girl, Patsy, who has been working here the last few months. You know who she is, Matt?
Yeah. Her name's Evie Taggart. Her father came out from the East yesterday.
Yeah, I know. I met him. Do you know he's trying to force her to go back to New York with him?
Uh-huh.
Well, he didn't waste any time going into action. He just sent a few telegrams east, and that did it.
Oh, did what?
Well, Mr. Botkin came over from the bank this afternoon. He was real apologetic, but he had orders from the big bank back east that holds part of his stock.
Oh, one of Taggart's banks.
Yeah. Either I fired Evie or Botkin had called in our loan. And just a half hour later, I got a telegram from our wholesaler in Kansas City. Fire Evie or pay up all our consignment accounts immediately. I let it go, Matt. I had to.
You couldn't do much of anything else, could you?
I got my partner to think about. The girls. You can't fight an army barehanded.
Now, there's no reason to feel guilty, Kitty. You didn't have much choice.
Well, I don't claim the life she's leading here is very good, but good or bad, at least what she wants to do, and she ought to have the right.
You know, rights are pretty hard things to hang on to sometimes.
Well, if there'd been any other way
well,
at all...
there you are.
What?
So he scared you off, huh? You started the ball rolling, now nobody will hire
you. Take it easy, Burl.
Well, whose side are you on anyway, Marshal?
There's no law against what Taggart did, Burl, and Kitty didn't have any choice. She had to go along with it.
The word's out all over town. Nobody will give her a job. They're afraid of his money.
Well, I got reason to be.
He's trying to starve her out. He thinks he'll get her back home that way.
Well, it's worked before.
Well, it won't this time.
We'll figure some way to beat that old buzzard.
Why don't you support her, Mr. Alden? I assume you are Burl Alden.
I guess you're Taggart. Huh?
That's correct. As I said, why don't you support her? I understand she's been supporting you for several months.
That's a lie. I got a job.
Yes, yes, part-time. But you've been taking money from her, haven't you?
Them was loans. What are you getting at, anyway?
The fact that you're an utterly worthless loafer who lives off the earnings of a woman.
Why, you dirty old...
All right, hold it, Burl. That's enough.
Go on. Who do you think he's talking to?
Can I give you a hand, Mr. Taggart?
No, thank you. It would seem to me that it's your job to prevent such occurrences, Marshal.
You can sign a complaint if you like.
No, thank you. I have something rather more drastic in mind. Good evening, gentlemen.
That's a cold fish.
What's he talking about, Marshal? He can't do nothing to me.
I wouldn't bet on that, Burl.
Good morning, Mac.
Oh, hello. Hello, Don. Come on in.
Oh, Chester, for heaven's sakes, put that thing away.
Now, there's some coffee on the top of the stove. I don't guarantee it, though. Our duck made it.
Well, then I pass.
Oh, you drunk it plenty of times before, and it never hurts you none, Doc.
Well, a man's luck runs out, Chester.
Pull up a chair, Doc.
No. Haven't got time, man. I don't have a plush-lined seat at the public trough. Like some people I know.
Oh, is that so?
A professional man like myself has to get out and scramble if he wants to keep body and soul together.
Doc, the only time I ever seen you scramble is when Sam Noonan says, have one on the house, boys.
Oh, is that so? For 2 cents, I wouldn't even tell you what I know.
All right, what do you know, Doc?
Oh, yes, now you got your ears off, ain't you? Yeah, you're starting to sing a different tune now.
Doc.
It's a fine thing when I have to do your job alone with my own. Just out of the kindness of my heart.
Doc.
There's going to be a killing.
Killing? How do you know?
Because I keep my mouth shut and my ears open. Do you know a gunman named Bill Jacks?
Yeah, he's been around town for a month or so. Why?
Well, they say that old man Taggart's hired him to kill Burl Alden.
Oh. So that's what Taggart meant about something more drastic.
Yes. Well, anyway, I've done all the brain work for you now. Go on out and arrest them.
On what charge, Doc? They'll both deny it.
Well, you aren't just going to sit there and let it happen, are you?
And I'll listen to suggestions, Doc, but in the long run, it'll probably come to just that. Matt Dillon, let me in.
Evie ain't here, Marshal. She went down to the Chinaman's to bring some grub.
Now, you're the one I want to see, Burl.
All right. Come on in. What is it? What do you want?
Burl, you made a bad enemy when you knocked old man Taggart down.
I'll knock him down 7 days a week if he don't stay away from us.
Oh, he'll stay away, all right. But the man he's hired to kid you won't.
What are you talking about?
Well, the word's out that he's offered Bill Jacks $2,000 to put you on Boot Hill.
Well, you got to do something, Marshal. I know about Jacks. You got to arrest him.
I got no proof, Burl. All I can do is warn you.
Well, then I got to get out of here. I got to get out of town right now. I'll get a horse from Moss Grimmick and head south.
Well, what about Evie?
Evie? Well, she'll be better off back home anyway.
Oh, I see.
Well, hitting the trail on the run, that ain't no kind of a life for a woman.
You think the Long Branch is any better?
Now, you got no call to talk like that.
What's going on?
Evie, you tell her, Marshal.
Burl, where are you going? Burl!
It's no use, Evie. He's gone.
Gone where? What do you mean?
Now, your father hired a gunman to kill him.
So Burl's getting out. Running away, leaving me.
Well, I guess a lot of men would act that same way under the circumstances.
Don't try to make excuses for him, Marshal. I know the kind he is. I've known all along.
Oh?
The life I've been living the last year isn't a very pretty one. I admit it. I guess I've done it on purpose. Sunk as low as I could. It's a way of hitting back at my father.
Yeah, it works that way sometimes.
Wasn't a very pretty life at home either, Marshal.
No, I guess not. Or it wouldn't have turned you to this.
Hired killer. Well, at least I'll get that stopped. Burl doesn't deserve dying. He's just what he is, and that's all he claims to be. There's no reason he should pay. But my father's going to. I'm going to see that he pays.
Pays how?
I don't know exactly. But he's going to. He's going to pay for things once and for all.
Well, it don't look to me like neither one of them ain't going to show up, Mr. Dillon.
They might not, Chester. All I know is Taggart bought two tickets back east on this afternoon's train.
I swear I never thought Evie'd give in and go back with him.
Well, he's a hard man to beat.
It's just a doggone shame the way he goes around treating people and gets by with it.
He won't get by with it forever, Chester. If you keep pushing people around, sooner or later, you're going to push one of them a little too far.
Uh-oh. Speak of the devil, Mr. Dillon.
Yeah, and by himself, too.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Nice of you to drop around to see us off.
Us, Mr. Taggart?
Oh, my daughter is just looking after some detail of her luggage. She'll be along. As much as I hate to disappoint you, Marshal.
Why would it disappoint me? It's none of my business.
No, not officially, of course. But I imagine you did hold certain personal opinions.
Yeah, I still do, as a matter of fact.
Indeed, such as?
Such as, I think you're making a big mistake taking that girl back against her will.
Oh, I assure you I am using no straitjacket or manacles.
It amounts to that, though. Why don't you give her a chance, Mr. Taggart? You can get her out of Dodge if you want, away from what she's been doing, but why don't you let her live her own life?
She will live precisely as I tell her to live, Marshal.
Won't work that way, Mr. Taggart. You can't treat people like horses. You can't own people.
Marshal, I've built an empire on the principle of owning people. I own hundreds of them, body and soul, lock, stock, and barrel. I call the tune, and they dance, and she will dance with them.
You ready, Father?
Quite ready, my dear.
Then let's go.
Good day, gentlemen.
Goodbye, Evie. Good luck.
Thank you, Marshal. But I think we may meet again soon.
Come along, Evie.
Yes, Father.
Just looky there. Just look how he's broke her spirit, Mr. Dillon. She's going along meek as a lamb.
Yeah, it looks that way. Now, what's he doing here?
That's Bill Jacks.
I want to talk with you, Taggart.
Come on, Chester.
Look here, Jacks. There's nothing for us to talk about.
All right, hold it, Jacks.
You stay out of this.
What are you up to?
Don't try it, Jacks. You drop your gun or I'll fire. Now, drop it!
You got him, Mr. Dillon?
Your father's dead, too, Evie.
Poor father.
So this is how he was supposed to pay, huh?
I don't know what you mean, Marshal. Probably had a disagreement over the price on Burl's head.
What price did you put on your father's head, Evie? How much were you going to pay Bill Jacks for this?
I can't prove a thing, Marshal. Not a thing.
Well, we'll let the judge decide that.
I don't care. As long as he finally lost.
What?
Father. Sure doesn't own anybody now, does he?
Les Crutchfield's script, Tag, You're It, originally heard October the 5th, 1958. Rex Corey was Gunsmoke's musical director. Corey entered radio in the 1930s, and his music has been heard on every major radio and TV network since then. Today, Rex is delighting theater audiences around the country with his pipe organ accompaniment for silent films. Corey is especially proud of the work he and his musicians performed on Gunsmoke, and he vividly recalls the first broadcast.
I remember that when we started the music on Gunsmoke, the very initial broadcast, we used a larger orchestra. In fact, the theme material, opening and closing, was recorded with a larger orchestra, and we continue to use that larger sound to give it a big and more impressive opening and closing. Then we went into what we called our standard, I think, 6 or 7 piece combo that we used, which not so much in the interest of economy, but for the specific sound that we wanted to acquire. We felt that a large orchestra was out of place with the time, the tempo. It didn't do the job for us. Whereas a small group, which included accordion, some harmonica, guitar, timpani effects, that sort of thing, were much more practical and aesthetically correct for the stories and the people involved.
In the smaller orchestra, Rex played the T accordion while he conducted.
Now, this was not the standard accordion that you strap on yourself. This was an electric T accordion, as we called it, which stood on its own standard, and you could regulate the volume from a pedal control. And the nice thing about it was that you could play both hands on the treble portion if you wanted to, or use the buttons or whatever. It was very flexible.
Announcer George Walsh has his own recollections of Corey's T accordion.
When they changed the orchestra from the full size that was probably 20 pieces, it became a much smaller group, and Rex changed. With the big orchestra, he played the organ, the pipe organ, and he used to conduct from the organ bench with body English. Well, when they cut down on the size of the orchestra, he went from the organ to an accordion. He had an electric accordion built. Now, I don't know whether this was his invention or not, but I had never seen one like it before. He didn't have to pump the bellows by hand. It became a T-shaped affair with an upright and then the accordion in two sections across the top, forming the T, so that with his right hand, he'd play the keyboard, and then with his left hand, he'd play the buttons, and then with his foot, he had a control of a pedal that gave him air pressure and so forth. And it was quite a strange-looking... Of course, Bill Conrad didn't have much respect for it. He referred to it as Rex Corey's electronic urinal.
I think that Bill set the tone and the pace for Jim Arness, who later followed. Now, of course, they're two different people and two different talents. But Bill had that a great ability to establish a character in your mind, to set an image. And Bill, being the type of performer he was, with such a wide range of capability, was perfect for the part of Matt Dillon, because Matt Dillon had to be a man who could be tough and who could be very sensitive at the same time. Bill had a very virile, manly voice, low-pitched. He could be very positive in his speech. He could be very tough and hard, and he could be very, very soft and sentimental. In approaching the music for the show and realizing that Bill was a central character who set the whole pace and tempo, I had to consider music that would be fitting and proper for this rather complex person. This meant that the music had to be coarse and rough and tough, and it also had to be very tender and touching.
Well, what can we do now, Dylan, to help you?
Oh, I buried Jed right here. Right here. He'd like that. It's about as far west as he'll ever get. Now...
It gave me a wide scope in which to operate musically, and it put demands on the musicians we had, because we had to produce tonal effects to suit the situation. And again, it became a wonderful challenge because you had such a wide latitude in which to work.
Many of the scenes in Gunsmoke took place in the Long Branch Saloon, and to provide just the right atmosphere, a barroom piano was necessary. Corey recalls how he first created that realistic sound.
We had to establish the very first scene in the Long Branch, and we had to establish the fact that there were all sorts of coarse Western characters involved, that there were dancing girls and various degrees of activity. And the music had to be something that would set the scene and yet be just a part of it. Nobody really knew what they wanted, I don't think. But I went over to the piano and I started messing around with it during rehearsal. Norman said, "Hey, that's good." He said, "What can we do to make it a little more tinny?" So we did the quickest thing we could do, and that was to get a whole bunch of paper clips and string them together and lay them over the strings. We later refined that by getting an old beat-up upright piano and putting thumbtacks in all the hammers so that we got a real honky-tonk sound out of it. And I also had to think about the type of melody that would have been popular at that time and still not come up with a recognizable piece of music. So it was always kind of improvised in the spot in a real sort of an early 19th century Western barroom style of composition. It got to be a thing where we would do things on the piano just for the entertainment of the cast, even during the broadcast, because extemporaneous noise and laughter was all to the good anyway. And I found that I was having a lot of fun being inventive and trying to get reaction out of the cast by the type of music I played.
My goodness, quite a crowd in the little Long Branch tonight. Over here, Matt. Come on over here and join us.
And there's Doc, Mr. Botkin. You want to join him, Mr.?
Yeah, might as well. Would you pardon me, please?
Hello, Matt. Good to see you.
Hello, Kitty.
Can I get you something?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, you can. The usual, if you don't mind.
The same for me, Miss Kitty. We'll be over at the table there at the dock.
All right, fine. I'll join you.
Good.
Pull up a chair, Matt. Winchester. Join us solid, respectable citizens for a change.
Well, there's some who would agree with you, Doc. How are you, Miss Falcon?
Fine, Marshal. Now buy you a drink?
Well, I got one coming, thanks. I just saw Miss Gross outside. She tells me she's going back east.
Well, I can't say I'm sorry to hear it. For some reason, she seems to blame me for what her son did.
Yeah.
Most of us felt that we would make the transition normally and naturally. Certainly in my particular experience, that was the way it worked. I knew that I was going to make the transition. In fact, I was already making the transition. We were doing radio and television shows at the same time. With the particular cast of Gunsmoke, the blow was a very hurting one for those involved when CBS decided to go ahead and produce it as a television show. It was a big disappointment. They had figured, I'm sure, that they would go ahead and work into the television aspect. The whole accent was on the television series. The musical direction for it had passed into the hands of the man who was then, Mr. Gluskin, who was then the musical director for the CBS network on the West Coast. He had gotten full control of the situation, and I did some composition here and there. And on top of that, some of the radio music has been carried over and used into the television series as such. When the show went to an hour-long production, it was obvious that one composer couldn't begin to handle it all anyway, so there have been various writers along over the years that have contributed to the music that is being used on Gunsmoke.
In 1957, the radio show was dealt two severe blows. First, Liggett and Myers dropped full sponsorship of the series. This led CBS to offer the program to participating advertisers. Complicating matters was the poor economic health of network radio in general. Thanks to television, advertisers were becoming reluctant to sink huge sums of money into a medium that supposedly had a dwindling audience. As a result, the network was finding it increasingly difficult to sell all the commercial time available. Public service announcements and promos started to fill the slots where only months ago, announcers George Fenneman and George Walsh extolled the delights of smoking L&M cigarettes. The second serious blow to the radio program was the loss of the live orchestra, recounted by Rex Corey.
For economic reasons, it had been discovered that live orchestras might not be all that necessary. Now, this unfortunately was triggered by a rather tragic and ill-timed musician strike called by the AF of M, the American Federation of Musicians, at a time when I suppose the timing was right for experimentation with recorded cues and bridges and backgrounds. I say it was ill-timed because it taught the producers and the networks that they could get along without live music. Not only did it hurt the professional musicians who were involved on many of these broadcasts, but it damaged the caliber of music, because instead of having music specifically designed for a given situation or a given performance, they were picking up on a hit-or-miss basis recorded music of various sorts, imported from various parts of the world, with various combinations, and so much of the music didn't fit. And unfortunately, our listening public has become conditioned to poorer music in much of our drama today, in television and in many other uses, because of this.
Gunsmoke started on the air in 52, as we've mentioned, and network radio was beginning to die just at the time we were starting. I guess what I mean is that in those early days, if you were doing a series and the series was canceled, something else popped up and you were told to start preparing for a show called such and such, which would go on the air next Tuesday. There was always something to replace the show that went off the air. By the end of the 50s, and certainly by the 60s, when a show went off the air, that was just the end of that half hour or that hour or that two-hour segment, and it was filled with something else. And that something else usually came from New York. It was a sad period for those of us who were fond of radio and enjoyed radio, and indeed had been brought up in radio. And it was not, believe me, a matter of sour grapes, because all of us who were then working on the radio show were also busy and gainfully employed on the television show or some other television show. Bill Conrad was producing and directing in television. Later he became an executive at Warner Brothers. At the same time, John Meston was writing, I think he wrote as many as 40 half-hour television episodes in 1 year. He was also writing regularly, when it went to an hour, the television version, some 12 to 15 episodes a year. So we were all busy. But it was really the fact that dramatic radio from the West Coast was drying up. Gunsmoke passed away, if you will, just at a time when there were new kinds of audio equipment coming on the scene that would have made it marvelous. For instance, if Gunsmoke had been done in stereo or quadraphonic, if you can picture Matt's horse coming down Front Street, the whole length of it, passing from one side of your living room to the other, just as it passed from one end of Dodge to the other, or Matt's booted feet working their way all the way across the street and up the steps and into Doc's office on the second floor. It would have been rather wonderful to hear this, but radio was already on its way out then.
As a footnote, Gunsmoke had the dubious distinction of being the last network dramatic program to originate in Hollywood.